Hey there, welcome to SaaS Unbound Podcast. I'm your host, Nadine, Head of Growth at SaaS Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful SaaS businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. So today with me is Michael, founder of Spiffy Checkouts, an intelligence checkout page platform. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. Of course. I mean, it's a great story. And, you know, when we talked discussed the podcast, you said immediately, like, I want to talk about bootstrapping. I want to talk about sustainable growth. And I'm like, oh, okay. I love those stories. So, you know, really happy to talk to you about this. But before we jump into it, maybe a bit about your background and, you know, how you got to do what you're doing.
Yeah, so my entrepreneurship journey started at 17, so I got an early taste of the entrepreneurial spirit and journey, and through that process, learned about personal development and personal success and growth and motivational speaking, and somewhere along the line, someone told me that being a public speaker was the highest paid profession, and so I heard that. I'm like, whoa, cool. You get to impact lives and make a ton of money. I want to do that someday. But I was, you know, 17, 18 year old kid, and kind of thought to myself, okay, what skill sets do I need to learn in order to be able to do that one day? And marketing and sales was that skill set that came to mind. So long story short, started a marketing company, started doing a lot of online marketing services for online businesses, specifically authors, speakers, coaches, thought leaders, personal brands. Built an agency, being a practitioner in that space, doing big 7- and 8-figure product launches for a lot of clients, used all the software out there, saw all the limitations with a lot of the different tools, ultimately jumped from tool to tool, realized the ideal solution that we wished that we had didn't exist. And we rolled up our sleeves and decided to build that solution we wish we had.
Okay, that's pretty great. So you started with the service like many other SaaS founders. And I wonder how the transition went, because you were working with public speakers and doing marketing for your clients. And you went into, at least from my point of view, into a completely different space. So how was the transition? And maybe, because when you're working with clients like that, I feel like it's a bit more of a B2C kind of approach. So what did you take from that, like, service sales into B2B?
Yeah. So our product, we still work with that same target market today. So while it might seem like it's a big departure from what we were doing, it's still very much what we do today. So a lot of authors, speakers, coaches, thought leaders, people selling services and digital products use Spiffy Checkouts to make it really easy to build a high converting, seamless checkout experience without having to know code. So doing things like post purchase, one-click upsells, offer bumps, payment plans, billing automation, updating cards on file, all these things that all the other tools out there just kind of missed the mark. And so it was actually pretty challenging to make that switch from a services company to a tech company and a software company. We bootstrapped the entire thing, self-funded it. And ultimately it came back to just knowing the market inside out, backwards and forward, building relationships with people that could accelerate the growth on the software side so that we didn't have to raise capital. Not saying that the way that we did it was the right way, it's just a different way. And it comes with its own challenges and its own pain points and its own lessons and learnings. However, I think that today there's been enough evidence showing companies that just raise a ton of money on a good idea and hire good developers. Like if having money and being able to access talent were the two variables that mattered, there'd be a lot more successful software companies out there. So those two things aren't the thing. And those are the two things that most people put all the emphasis on, is I need to have a really good idea where I can tell a story that gets people to take out their pocket, you know, out their wallets and write a check. And I need to hire the best talent. But those two things aren't the magic sauce. The magic sauce is knowing the market inside out, backwards and forward. And so I firmly believe about our story is that was the precursor to our success was doing it. It was building a company, providing a service first to get paid to learn the market, to get paid to learn the existing landscape of software out there so that we could build something that was truly differentiated. We already had connections, we already knew customers, and we could deploy our product to the market a lot faster than just spending a bunch of money on ads and kind of faking traction. So those are some of a little bit more about our story and some of my core beliefs.
Yeah, I've had a lot of founders here on the podcast who started with service. And to be honest, I think like more than half of them said, I would never do it again. Like, I would never start with the service. So you seem like on the other side of the spectrum.
Well, I would agree. I don't know that I would ever do it again. However, if you're just getting started, it's a great way to get paid to learn, to really get paid to understand the landscape of things. And so I think once you cut your teeth on it, I mean, I would never, ever start another company ever again, with at least with my own money. I would either acquire another company or I would go and raise funds. But it's very different once you already have connections, you already have relationships, you've already have team and talent and different connections. You're just playing a much different game than if you just have an idea and you're just getting started and you're bootstrapping your idea. So I agree with that sentiment too. Like, I think that, you know, if you're just getting started and you have this big idea and this big vision and you don't have VC relationships and you don't have talent acquisition and you don't have connections, the best way to actually bring that vision to life is to provide services for people to build out your connections, to build out your Rolodex, to, you know, leverage introductions, to meet VCs so that maybe you do raise money at some point or for your next idea. So, you know, there's no one size fits all answer for everyone, but I do think that building a software company out of a service company is one of, it might not be the fastest way, but for me, it's the most sure way to actually have success.
That's really funny because that's also a very common answer. Like, you know, bootstrapping is a hot potato now. Like, everyone wants to be a bootstrapper. It's a bootstrapper or, you know, what are you even doing with your life, right? But at the same time, you know, a lot of founders say that, hey, you know what? Like, it worked and it's great. We have the freedom and we have a way to determine our path and everything. But if I do it again, I'll probably go and raise because it's like, man, it's not easy. So... It seems like if it works, it's amazing, but it's definitely way harder than people expect it to be.
Yeah, I mean, raising money is really hard, way harder than people expect it to be too. Like you said, you don't have a freedom. You have a responsibility to give people return on their money. So, you know, that's one of the things that I'm very passionate about speaking out against or shedding light on is like the SaaS industry in general glorifies people raising money. And, you know, I have friends that have raised money and you know, $8 million, $17 million, $28 million raised. And it's really important to like not have comparison syndrome and like look like those people as like, oh man, they're like crushing it. It's like, I look at that and it's like their investors want a 3, 5, or 10X on that money. So they just raised $8 million. But what they really did is signed the next 5 to 10 years of their life to committing to turning their business that's just an idea into something that's worth $80 million. To me, that's like kind of putting some golden handcuffs on. And so you have to kind of really get clear on your core values. Like, what do you value? Do you want to build a company that hits those types of numbers and deal with the struggles of building team and building systems and building operations? Or do you actually really just truly value freedom? And I know friends who have built companies that are $40, $50 million a year in revenue, but their actual take-home pay is the same as some of my friends that built like really nice freelancer businesses. And they're bringing in a couple $100,000 a year, time freedom, money freedom. And so when it comes to building a business, it's really important that you first know what you're building, know what you value so that you can make sure that you're not building something that's the antithesis of what you actually want.
Yeah, absolutely. What were the, maybe the cons? And I understand that, you know, you have that service business that's working really well and it's still, you know, it was your way to, what is the word I'm looking for? Ah, oh my God, to pay, to sponsor? No. Yeah,
finance, to
finance. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Yeah. It was your way to finance your SaaS. So you had a bit of a head start, but still, what were the cons? What were the constraints that you worked with? And maybe if you have an advice on like how to make those constraints work for you, that would be great too.
Yeah. So when it comes to those early days, like everyone is constrained by time and money. And so you really have to get resourceful. And I think that one of the things that we did very different than what I see other people doing is that we were just super, super scrappy. Like there's the concept of, you know, the customer just wants to go from point A to point B. And we think that they need a Ferrari to go from point A to point B, something really fancy, super powerful engine, when like all they need is a skateboard. They just want to get there a little bit faster than they can do it on their own. And so we were really, really good about what is that? What is the piece of our biggest vision that is the thing that people are willing to pay for? And how can we start, how can we build something very, very simple that solves that problem? And so we can start generating revenue quickly. We started selling apps for Spiffy before there was even a login page. There was no ability for a customer to log in. There was no, you know, dashboard. There was no analytics. Like, we sold a little code snippet for $300 a year, annual subscription only, that we would basically generate manually in our database and send them via email that they could copy and paste into a tool that they were already using. And that was version one of Spiffy. And, you know, quickly, like, we made, you know, our first 10, 15 sales, you know, we're building the plane as we're flying it, but we just really we as founders put too much emphasis on things that really the customer isn't necessarily willing to pay for. And, you know, again, it's not to say that we didn't have to quickly add other features and other benefits and things of this nature, but we just got started really simple. Start selling way earlier than you think you need to sell. Start building something very simple. Get really clear on the core problem that you're solving and do just that. Add all the bells and whistles later. Ultimately, Jeremy, my co-founder, and I, because we had our agency and because we had revenue, we didn't take any money out of Spiffy for the first 2 full years. So all of the profits that we were generating went immediately to hire our first developer, so someone could be working on it full time while we were focused on the thing that was actually making us money. So I think that's another big misconception of bootstrapping, is that bootstrapping is, you know, a way to start a business with no money. Every business needs capital in order to get off the ground and needs sweat equity and capital. And so whether you're taking on outside investors or you're starting a business on your own, you know, bootstrapping, like, you need to have some type of revenue stream coming in so that you can actually put money into the business to get it up and running. That's one big mistake that I see a lot of people make, is they quit their job and they start their SaaS idea that they've had. Or, you know, there's so much talk in the entrepreneurship community about hustle, 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 grind, 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 no plan B, only plan A, burn all the ships, quit your job, jump in. If you're not, you know, working 14 hours a day, then you're lazy, or, you know, all that messaging is being bombarded at us nonstop. And it's much better to be able to have revenue coming in so that you can finance your idea, rather than just scraping by to, you know, hopefully get some traction.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's, if you're just hustling all the time and like working 14 hours a day, I don't think like calling yourself an entrepreneur or like a founder is just a very fancy way of like being a freelancer with, you know, lots of.
Yep. And we were that for a while. Like, you know, we had an air quotes agency, but at the end of the day, we were glorified freelancers. You know, one of my litmus tests to really know if you have a business or if you're just self-employed is it's the 30-day vacation test. Could you step away from your business for 30 days and would it maintain itself or would it grow? If the answer is yes, then you have a business. If your answer is no, then essentially you're a glorified freelancer. And so for a long time, there was, you know, times where you know, I was in business, I had clients, I was generating revenue, but it was very much dependent on my efforts. And that's the beautiful thing about SaaS and starting with services. You get paid to learn, you get to build a tool that you know that the market needs, you get paid to get people on your product, because ideally you're building something that's synergistic with the service that you're providing. And then you can build that recurring revenue and that recurring revenue so that you can actually build something that's a true business, that's an asset, that's sellable, that's you know, creating freedom short term. Maybe it's just a lifestyle business that maybe you don't sell. You just have a lot more optionality around SaaS. And that's why I'm a big believer in every service business should have some R&D arm that's doing something to take their knowledge and their learnings and their findings to build a SaaS product.
Yeah, that makes great sense. All right. So I actually was listening to one of your previous podcasts, and I remember you said something about your kind of ideation stage where you had about 20 ideas and then you landed on Spiffy and decided that this is the one you're going to go with. And, you know, it starts to kind of shape for me as we're talking. But, you know, when I first heard it, I was like, oh, that's really strange, because, like, you know, a lot of founders say you have to have this unfair advantage where, you know, it's either your personal problem that you've been dealing with, or, you know, it's just really the space where you're coming from. So I guess your stories is the second one. So when you were validating this idea, basically how much time did it take for you guys to land your first paying customer?
Yeah, so we landed our first paying customer super quick. It probably took us maybe 2 or 3 months to get the beginning workings of the technology dialed in. So like what we did was like we became known for customizing checkout processes on an existing CRM platform. And so we were doing it by hand coding it. That system worked in a way that was actually really difficult to do that. It wasn't straightforward as just writing basic HTML. We cracked the code on that, doing it manually, providing a service. And then I went to Jeremy one day. I'm like, hey, there's got to be a way to productize this because not everyone can afford to spend $2,500 to $5,000 just optimizing their checkout experience, like one page on their website. Like typically most people don't invest that much in their entire website, let alone just one page on their website. So there's a lot of people coming to us that needed the benefit of what we were offering, but couldn't afford to hire our expensive development team to do that. So I was like, there's got to be a way to productize this. And so essentially that was the evolution of version one of Spiffy, but that wasn't the big vision that we had. So the first step was getting really clear on what we wanted to do. We wanted to build a SaaS company that we could sell someday. And so in order to do that, it needed to be something that, one, was something that we were passionate about, two, solved a real problem in the marketplace, and then three, had enough upside potential to be something that could sell to hit some financial targets that we were dreaming about at that point. And so we had about 20 different ideas that we thought could be successful. They could be million-dollar ideas. There were about maybe 5 to 7 of them that we thought could be $5 million ideas, maybe 4 that we thought could be $10 million ideas, and like 2 or 3 that we thought could be $25 to $50 million ideas, like exit for a $25 to $50 million check. And so we, you know, just really analyzed the ideas that had the most legs, the best propensity for success. But ultimately, like the 3 biggest, most important aspects of building a business, actually the 4 most important things, but the one thing before that is, you know, a lot of times people hear about small business success rates and that, you know, 90%+ of small businesses go out of business. And a lot of people naturally just think, well, it's due to lack of resources. But ultimately, it comes down to lack of resourcefulness. And I think there's one thing even before that, and it's executing against the wrong idea. So there's no amount of resources that can make up for executing against the wrong idea. And so that was one of the things that we were really diligent about, was making sure that we're executing against the right idea. And so the 4 things are absolutely critical that you have to have in place. And there's other things, but these are the core 4 that you can usually invalidate a lot of ideas. One, you need to be solving an actual problem in the marketplace. 2, you need to make sure that the market is aware they have the problem. So it's not just like some edge case problem that this way far corner of the market, like 4 people actually know is a problem, but no one knows it's a problem. The market needs to be aware that it's a problem. 3, people need to be actively seeking a solution to the problem. The problem needs to be big enough, it's on people's radars, that they're actually looking to solve it. Otherwise, you're going to be spending a ton of money convincing people they have the problem, and or convincing people that the problem's big enough that they need to trade their attention to learn more about your product or service. And the last thing is that your product, your idea, your business, the problem that you're solving needs to be big enough that people are willing to trade dollars for it. So those 4 things again are: 1, solving a real problem; 2, the market's aware they have the problem; 3, the market's actively seeking a solution to the problem; and 4, they're willing to pay money for that solution. And when you have those 4 things in place, it makes it really easy to scale a business fast, because people are looking for you and they're wanting to give you money for solving a problem they know they already have, versus you having to spend money convincing people or on ads and funnels and just big expensive sponsorships to audiences of people that don't even know that what you're solving is actually something that they need, right? And so those 4 things for Spiffy were very obvious. Spiffy was the idea that had the highest upside potential with the least amount of downside risk. When you build your own custom payments platform, you can pivot 12 ways to Sunday. So like if next week the market shifted and we need to become a CRM for yoga studios or something, we have our own billing platform. We could bring it internal and apply it to a different business that we start, or we could pivot to a lot of different ways. So executing against this idea had a ton of upside potential and virtually no risk. And so that's why we decided to go execute against this idea.
Oh, right. And it seems like, because you said exit is something that was on your radar from the very beginning. So are there any things that you're doing specifically to maybe make this process easier down the line?
Yeah. So just like, one, how we structure everything, from, you know, a legal standpoint, to also just making sure that we're building systems and processes. You know, one of the most important aspects of of an acquisition is transferable value. And so making sure that we're building out Spiffy with multiple revenue streams focused on proactively not just building the product, but building the whole ecosystem of what it takes to build a successful company. So we've spent a lot of time, energy, effort, resources in our help center and getting really good documentation. We apply a lot of resources into quality customer support, which helps with retention. One, just running a solid business in general, but then making sure that you have systems, documentation, standard operating procedures for the business so that the business can really run without you and so that you can get the highest valuation possible when it is time to exit.
So you're actually living that rule, that 30-day rule yourself.
I try to, yeah. For the longest time, I discounted standard operating procedures and SOPs. And like you just hear it, and it's not fun work to do. But as a founder, if your goal is to exit, like really emphasizing systems, operating procedures, simplifying things, not building out every single feature that a customer asks for, just making things simple, easy to operate, repeatable. And, you know, really the goal behind it is when you build out a business that's well run, that's simple, that's easy to run, then people are willing to pay a premium to acquire that business.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what your kind of dream exit looks like? And what do you want to do when you sell?
Yeah, I mean, our goal is something north of that $50 million mark. I think, you know, currently we're sitting somewhere around a $10 million valuation. So we feel like we're just getting started. And so, entrepreneurship runs in my veins. And so, you know, hopefully we can have another 2 or 3 year run at this, hit our goal and figure out what the next project is that we want to tackle, what the next problem that we want to solve and play it at a bigger level.
All right. So we shouldn't try and buy you just yet. Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you, because I wanted to understand a little bit more about the use case. Walk me through the use case and tell me if, you know, we're doing this M&A course, right? And I'm thinking like, if, and no, absolutely, this is not an idea, it's going to be completely free. But if at some point we decided, hey, let's slap a $9 price on it, right? Do I need Spiffy for this? Or would you tell me there are easier solutions out there on the market and I don't really need something as sophisticated as Spiffy for this?
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Yeah, so it really depends. I mean, I guess going back to your first question, the use case, the core value proposition of Spiffy is increasing conversions at checkout. Then our secondary and tertiary value propositions are automating different things around purchase-related events and billing-related events. So automating your customer journey, automating failed payment follow-up, make it really easy for people running subscription-based businesses for their customers to update their card on file. And then the third thing is reporting, analytics, and day-to-day operations and management, make it easy to issue partial refunds, make it easy to edit payment plans that are already active, changing billing dates, changing the amount, so on and so forth. While our core value proposition is increasing average order value, converting more sales, and very revenue-focused, there's a lot of other benefits to Spiffy as well. To answer your question about whether or not Spiffy would be a good solution for you guys with your course, it really depends. So where Spiffy really makes sense and where Spiffy actually legitimately pays for itself is when people are at about that 300K mark in their business, selling online courses, selling events, selling workshops, maybe virtual events, selling consulting services, agency services. at that point, it makes a lot of sense. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of the landscape, there's a lot of solutions out there that take payments, but it's always a secondary or tertiary feature. And nobody really just is solving the payments industry, you know, the payments aspect in the industry that we're in a really eloquent way. And so that's what we realized. So like, all these tools are meant to help people build online businesses. And the whole point of having an online business is to make money online. But why are all these systems not making it easy to take payments? Or maybe they do make it easy to take payments, but they don't integrate back with HubSpot or Keep or ActiveCampaign. And so now your data is fragmented across two different platforms versus having all of your data in your CRM where it's most valuable. And so those are the pain points that we solved. And so, you know, ultimately there's tools like Kajabi, really great course platform, okay at taking payments. Keep, really great marketing automation and CRM for small business, not very good at taking payments. ClickFunnels, great page builder, great funnel builder, also kind of sort of takes payments. QuickBooks, accounting software, kind of takes payments. You know, so like all these different tools, like payments is just like the kicker feature. And so we decided to plant our flag and build a tool that just focuses on creating a seamless checkout experience. And so, you know, Spiffy is not necessarily the best tool if you're just getting started, unless you really value customer experience and having nice, beautiful checkout pages. But it really makes a lot of sense if you're sending cold traffic to an offer, running low ticket offers off of ads. If you're selling courses, you're doing product launches, you have a big list and you're sending promotions, that's where Spiffy can convert more sales, and the value proposition makes a lot of sense.
All right, great. So it really looks like you chose your niche, and I'm wondering how you were niching down. Like, what were the steps? Because I think that's something you were also talking about on another episode. And I was wondering, yeah, obviously everyone says that, hey, you have to start small. You really have to know your customer. But, you know, for a lot of founders, first of all, it's a huge FOMO, right? Why are we leaving money on the table? What if we could be that first tool that is in the market for men and women from 18 to 75. So what was the journey for you?
Yeah, I think this is honestly one of the places where maybe we actually didn't niche down far enough, surprising or not. Like, we built a very flexible system and we intentionally didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves into building a technology that had a bunch of technical debt or was constrained. And also we just needed to get traction from and make sure that, you know, we're listening to customers and we're building features that people actually want versus just based off of our assumptions. You know, our assumptions we knew were directionally correct. But it's so critically important to build a software or any company that has a very specific value proposition. And especially when you have limited resources as a bootstrap startup, it helps you focus on where to spend those marketing dollars. If you have a software for a dentist, you don't need to wonder what conferences are good to sponsor. You go sponsor the dental conferences. You know, like, who are the experts and the thought leaders in the dental space? You go find everyone that's written a book in dentistry and go network and build relationships. Join masterminds in the dental space, right? And so it might be scary to have some type of healthcare idea and you want to have this big mission and vision to change healthcare in general, but like, starting with one aspect of healthcare, getting really, really niche, it allows you to apply your limited resources of time and money in a direction that gets traction much faster than having this big, huge healthcare idea. And it's like, which healthcare conference do we sponsor and who do we reach out to? And so even just like niching down to a specific industry can also be not niche enough, if that makes sense. But it's critically important. People are willing to pay a premium for a real pain point that's specific to their needs. And so I think that's a big lesson that's understandably scary and so critically important.
Yeah, absolutely. And where do you find your customers? Like, because, you know, obviously I went through your LinkedIn and the pages that you have, and it doesn't look like LinkedIn is the one for you where, you know, you're very present. So, which was like, oh, interesting. Probably the first B2B business on the podcast that is not that active on LinkedIn. So where do you find your people? How did you find where they hang out?
Yeah, great question. So going back to those four core elements of, you know, ultimately people looking for you and willing to pay for your solution, we're just very good at finding those people. One of our best platforms is YouTube, where people will find us organically. So we build very specific YouTube videos with long tail keywords that match our core benefits or match a problem that someone's looking to solve for that our solution uniquely solves. For instance, we integrate with Stripe and PayPal for credit card processing. We have the best integration with ActiveCampaign. If someone searches best Stripe integration ActiveCampaign, my video with my face shows up. I communicate why Spiffy is the best way to connect ActiveCampaign and Stripe and all the benefits their integration does that others don't. Talk about Spiffy a little bit, just pique their interest. They book a call, they sign up for the product, they, you know, kind of take their next steps. Do those videos go viral? No. Those they're called what's called low view, high value views. And so those videos might only get 500 or 1,000 views, but they're 500 or 1,000 of the right views. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is building relationships with channel partners. So versus us going out there and trying to hunt down or optimize ads to convert one customer, we build relationships with agencies who are already trusted sources and trusted advisors that have that trust already built with their clients. And so we build relationships with agencies where that one relationship can generate 15, 20, 100 different clients for customers for us from their clients over the course of a year. So rather than us having to build each relationship one by one, we build one relationship that branches out to hundreds of customers over a year or multiple years. And then the third avenue is through our integration partners. So through integration partners like ActiveCampaign, Keep, HubSpot, you know, we actually do trainings for employees at those companies. And so that when a customer has an issue that our problem uniquely solves, that essentially we have a free workforce of salespeople in these companies. Now, are they on calls dialing every single day? No, it's much more of a passive response, but there are people inside the walls of other software companies talking about our product. And so that's how people find us.
That's amazing. I think that's the first time anybody's ever told me here that they leverage YouTube for growth. And, you know, also was very like kind of honest, right? About how did you call it? Low views, high value.
Yep.
Because I think, you know, the narrative, at least, you know, if you're in marketing, the narrative is like, if you're doing YouTube or if you're doing like any kind of like social media, it has to go viral or, you know, you're not doing a good job. And I completely agree with you. Like it doesn't have to be millions of people because ultimately not the entire million who's going to watch this is going to come to you, right? So I feel like it's better if you just target the right people and don't like waste others' time.
Totally. Especially in SaaS, like it's not something that you're going to go viral for. But as a creator, like you're like, oh, only 100 people watched that and I spent 2 hours creating it. And like snap a picture and I post it on Facebook. And because we're that social generation, you know, 300 people liked it, right? And so you see 100 views on YouTube versus that you spend a lot of time on versus 300 people on your Facebook page that you just spent, you know, 30 seconds on. And so like our human brain equates that YouTube experience to pain. It's like more time and like no one watched it. But it's like understanding the people that watch that are people that are searching for the problem that you're solving. And so you have to really disconnect like the ego that's attached to that, the view count, the visitor count, to detach the ego from the actual result.
Yeah. Vanity metrics can be super cool, but you know, not everything you're looking for, definitely. So what's in your personal, completely unbiased view, what is the most fascinating thing about Spiffy?
Yeah. So, you know, ultimately the most fascinating thing about Spiffy is me starting my marketing company and, you know, back in 2010 and really getting into online marketing in 2008 and 2009 and all the thought leaders that were really big in that day, people like Frank Kern, people like Brendan Burchard, people like Jeff Walker, Ryan Dice and Roland Frazier. These are big names in the online marketing space that I looked up to, that I learned from. The most fascinating thing is just like, it's just cool how life kind of works. And over the past 10, 15 years of this journey, building a SaaS product that then those people I looked up to now use our software. And it wasn't through, us strong arming sales or, you know, dialing for dollars. It was just from like building a really good product that's actually the best product in the industry and that those people want to use because it drives results for their business.
Yeah, awesome. All right. I want to, you know, capture a little bit more with this, like, what fascinates you about what you're building. But still, was there a mistake, a failure that you're looking back to and you're like, oh, man, wish it didn't happen?
We didn't have any catastrophic mistakes, but it's taken a lot longer to get to this point than we originally anticipated. Version one of Spiffy was an app for an existing ecosystem that met those four core pillars of solving an existing problem that people are aware of, they're actively seeking a solution for, and they're willing to pay for. And so we were able to scale up to $500,000 in revenue in 2 years with zero marketing. And so that solving a pain point for an existing ecosystem that's already looking for you and willing to pay for that solution was, you know, a really quick lesson. And then we took our learnings from that to build the platform that we really dreamed of. And there's a massive difference that we underestimated between building an app for an existing ecosystem and actually building your own platform. And so I think the biggest mistake that we made, just to be fully transparent, was just underestimating the amount of development, time, energy, effort, and resources it takes to actually build your own platform and get people to move over to that platform. And it was just a lot heavier of a lift where, depending on what your goals are, you know, our goal was to exit. You know, if you just build a little app for an existing ecosystem, it might not be sellable, but it's like a little ATM machine that just prints cash. So if you're just looking to bootstrap some software ideas and to generate some cash flow, one of the best things that you can do is just focus on building use case featured and problem focused features for existing ecosystems. And it doesn't need to be the next Facebook. That was one of our biggest mistakes, underestimating that lift, the amount of time, energy, and effort. We probably could have built 30 different apps for various ecosystems and had a more diversified portfolio of different income streams. Again, that might not really be sellable. Each of those things might not have like a super long shelf life, but it just kind of depends on what your goals are. The second thing was having two different versions of our product created a lot of confusion in the marketplace. So I really underestimated the power of brand and the power of the consumer. Once a consumer has made up their mind of what something is, it's very, very, very difficult to change that. While we were very creative and resourceful and bootstrapping, it also came with its own challenges. And so I wouldn't say it's a mistake. Like, it was a necessary path for us to go to bootstrap our idea. And that was absolutely the best path that we could have taken, and I wouldn't do anything different. But it came with some unexpected challenges that we didn't see at the beginning.
Okay. All right. Well, it all worked out for you, right? So good learning.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So, you know, I just have one last question for you. And this is, again, the usual, and it's about a hack. You know, it can be anything. It can be your personal, you know, how to run a company, how to bootstrap, how to be focused on your exit, or anything that works that make it all, you know, worth it and successful.
Yeah. I mean, I think the YouTube thing is probably my biggest hack of just like being able to, you know, with a very limited budget, generate some traffic. I mean, doing that hack, it's the fastest way to get on the first page of Google. A lot of times people spend a bunch of money on SEO. It's like, if you just create those long tail keyword YouTube videos, it's the fastest way to get on the first page of Google. Usually you can get on the first page of Google within 24 to 48 hours of publishing that video. So if you're looking for like an SEO hack or a way to generate traffic, that's really the biggest hack on that front. And, you know, the other hack is, you know, as founders, we tend to be very myopic and very focused and driven. And that's really what makes us successful. It's how we tick. You know, we have these big ideas and these big goals and we're driven to accomplish them. But, you know, the other hack is, you know, early on in my career, I thought that taking a time out of my day to go take a walk in a park or take a break and take a breather, or get some sunlight, you know, it was like the worst, you know, the absolute most unproductive way to spend my time. But, you know, as I've, you know, gotten more wise and have more gray hairs, you know, that time is actually the most important time. Like, you need to have separation. You can't be working 14-hour days back to back to back, year after year after year. You need to create space for in life for magic to happen, for creativity to spawn. And if you're working, there's a season in the business that requires working really, really hard. But if you're doing that for a long period of time, then that's a sign that you might not be working on the right idea and that there might be an opportunity to pivot. Enjoy life along the way. Make sure that you're enjoying the process, making sure that you're taking care of yourself at the end of the day. We're doing this crazy entrepreneurship thing to provide for our families, to be fulfilling and to have fun. And it's easy to get wrapped up in the day-to-day grind and the problems and the challenges and the frustrations of not moving as fast as we want it to. So it's just important to have that perspective to remind ourselves to focus on the things that truly matter.
That's a great hack. Loving it. And honestly, somehow this last year had this narrative of a lot of founders coming on the podcast and saying, hey, you know what? We realized it's not about the grind. It's like you have to give yourself space. And the weirdest thing about it is that when you do, it doesn't take away from the business. It doesn't take away from your productivity. It kind of adds to it. So
totally, yeah. Totally. And just, you know, Pareto's principle, the 80-20 rule, you know, 80% of our efforts are only coming from 20%. 80% of our results are only coming from 20% of our efforts. And so at the beginning, you have to work really hard and do a lot of things to figure out which 20% is generating the 80% of results. And so you need to figure that out as quick as possible, because 80% of what we're doing on a day-to-day basis isn't moving the needle. And it's just causing unnecessary stress on ourselves, on our teams, on our personal relationships. And so again, there's a season where it's critical to just do a lot of different things, put irons in the fire, get traction, get customers, get feedback, get features. But you can't be doing that year after year after year after year. You got to have a light at the end of the tunnel where you can really focus on what are those things that we're doing that are moving the needle.
Oh, right. Wonderful. I'm really glad that we're finishing on that note, because, you know, it's a great reminder for a lot of founders out there. So thank you so much, Michael, for being here. It's a great story. Like, it's fascinating to see what you're building, how you're doing it. And thanks for great hacks. I actually, like, I have your file here, your questions, and I just underlined, like, great hack.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure being on today, and look forward to maybe doing an update in the future.
Would love to do it. So thank you so much for your time, and take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.